The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, we'll feature excerpts from a discussion held last night at the IMC, hosted by AWARE, the anti-war, anti-racism effort. The event was entitled, The Connections Between War and Racism, with a focus on the anti-war movement and participation by minorities in that movement. The quality of sound from these excerpts varies, and so I apologize in advance for the disparities in clarity. We'll start with AWARE volunteer Lisa Chasen, who introduces the speakers and provides context for the discussion.
Professor Sundiata Chajua directs the Afro-American Studies and Research Program and teaches history at UIUC. His published work is focused on African-American community building, radical Black intellectual thought, lynching and agency during the Nader, 1877 to 1917, and the contemporary Black freedom movement, 1966 to the present. He's author of the book America's First Black Town, Brooklyn, Illinois, 1830 to 1915, and numerous scholarly and popular articles. Professor David Roediger teaches Afro-American Studies and History at UIUC. He's director of the Center on Democracy in a Multiracial Society on campus. His most recent books include Colored White, Transcending the Racist Past, and as editor, W.E.B. Du Bois' John Brown. He's especially well known for his study on whiteness, when and why did people, and especially workers, become quote-unquote white, and what does capitalism have to do with the notion of whiteness? Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And welcome everyone who has joined us today. Now, I heard Professors Chajua and Roediger interviewed on Bob McChesney's weekly Media Matters radio program on WILL on Sunday afternoons at 1 o'clock, 580 a.m., in July. And there they were discussing something that we in AWARE had also been talking about, the whiteness of the current anti-war movement, and the meaning of anti-racism in the name of our organization, which is the anti-war, anti-racism effort, AWARE. The idea arose to invite you here to discuss this with us, and that's what led to today's event. I want to draw everybody's attention, please, to this recent publication. No, that's not it. The Connections Between War and Racism, one of the results of these discussions that has recently come out. Now, just a couple of remarks, please. The name of the organization is Anti-War, Anti-Racism Effort. Now, we don't all agree on what anti-war is. Some people adhere to pacifism, and which means they never condone violence, and this implies also vegetarianism or veganism, while others are attracted to the movement, the anti-war movement, because it's a way to counter American foreign policy. So those are two ways of being anti-war, and within the group, people have different adhere to different strains of anti-war. Well, similarly, people in the group have different understandings of what anti-racism means. And this is a matter for discussion. Is it significant to be anti-racist because this will broaden our base of support? Is it important to be multiracial because it makes you a stronger, more vibrant organization, just like women's participation in an organization is important because women bring different sensibilities, different organizing style, and a group would sorely miss the lack of women's participation? Or does it mean, as some argue, that by being anti-racist as well as anti-war, we are saying we are against the form of everyday violence that racism is? It's the meaning of war and racism that I'm sure will likely become part of the discussion today.
Is that a question of class, or is that a question of whiteness? The fact that a greater fraction of the Black population, African American population, has sensibilities against the war than that of the Caucasians, or whatever you want to call them?
You know, unfortunately, when they do these polls, they don't break them down in that way, so we're unable to really speak to that, you know, clearly. But my suspicion is that the anti-war sentiment runs through the overwhelming majority of African Americans, well, of course, the overwhelming majority of working class. But I would expect that the petty bourgeoisie, depending on specific location, tends to be more anti-war than their white colleagues.
It is really interesting how you would disentangle race and class here. And I keep going back into the anti-Vietnam War movement and thinking about this, because we all remember that movement as a white middle class movement. And if you look at footage, very often the mass demonstrations where people took off work and took buses to Washington really were largely white middle, it seemed to be white middle class. But opposition to the war in Vietnam was predicted by low income, not by high income. Working class people were more against the war. So, I mean, I think that there's a certain sense in which it's true that you have this opposition to war that's not mobilizable in the way that we yet know how to mobilize it among white workers and black workers. But when you're talking about a difference between 20% and 68%, that's a pretty stark difference. I think it also suggests that there's something that's also racialized about this.
There's some really strange things happening in that. On the one hand, yeah, we do look forward to a moment when we can talk beyond this. But in America, the most vital categories that have been racialized are black and white. The social system of racism that has grown up with capitalism in this society has mainly been propelled through the black-white interaction, and it's become the relationship that has shaped those other relationships between whites and other non-whites. And while on the one hand it's easy to say that we got to move beyond this binary language, the society is more multicultural, but the nature of the racist system is still animated and keyed by that difference, right? And if we start acting as if all racialized groups suffer the same type of oppression and thus should conceive the same types of solutions, I think that's a classic mistake. And particularly the way this society is developing at this moment, where we seem to be moving toward a kind of social relationship where what will matter in the society is that you're not black. That's what will come to matter most. We see that with taking people who are in color, often far darker than African Americans, Indians, particularly the Darvinians in the South, and they've become Caucasian in America. So there's some strange things going on. So I don't want to just endorse getting beyond race or getting beyond black and white without understanding that those are the most antagonistic units here. The other kind of piece in terms, see, I think that these identities reflect real interests. And while those interests may be complicated by class, it may be complicated by gender, to treat them as simply identity politics and dismiss them dismisses a real fundamental lived experience, right? There's something that happens being identified as black in this society that has a deep reservoir of experience where death is a possibility. And that, it's transmitted, you know what I mean? For those few who don't experience it, they learn it in other ways. And I don't think that that's something that we're trying to get beyond in terms of that, these are interests. These are political, social, economic, cultural interests that happen to reflect our bodies as marked as black.
To return to the original remarks about the size of
protest movement that was white and not being able to sway the rest of the whites. I was wondering whether race articulates with nationalist sentiment in a particular way. So for instance, I don't know, what I noticed on those weekly protests was that leading up, before we actually went to war, there was a lot of support, both from African Americans that were driving by, but also there was a building of support from white Americans too. When we went to war, there was a switch, I at least I perceived, so that the African Americans went by, still were supporting the anti-war protesters, but the white drivers at that point stopped, or at least we greatly reduced. I don't know whether other people
would agree. Sure.
That's true. Yes.
So what it seemed to me is that, and when I was thinking about that, trying to figure that out, so I have two thoughts. One is in terms of why can't white protesters sway all the rest of the whites? Well, in the first place, I don't think there's we're the unmarked category. Mm-hmm. So there's not a unity based on that. So that there are other things operating, but it seemed to me that this national sentiment, so that, you know, we've got to support our troops, et cetera, was much stronger. And at African Americans, maybe there's a stronger tradition of seeing through that.
I think that's a very perceptive observation.
Yeah.
Black people historically haven't felt that they're Americans, and I know, like, I don't feel like I'm American. I resist that term. Anybody here watch Bernie Mac, the Bernie Mac show? Probably not. Bernie Mac, African-American comedian, he has this show where he turns to the camera and speaks directly to the camera. And whenever he does that, he begins by saying, America. You see what's happening to Bernie Mac. And I asked my class one day, when Bernie Mac turns to the camera and says, America, who is he talking to? And every African-American student said, white folks. Black people do not really see themselves as American. We have to keep a distance there, because our experience is that, you know, you're not really. And so that allows you to be somewhat immune. But I would think that the same phenomena happened with African Americans, that once they went to war, the liberal leadership was able to get people to think that we must now support our troops. So there was probably a lessening of African American support as well, but not to the extent of whites, because whiteness and American nationalism are the same thing.
Martin Luther King in the Vietnam days was a great mobilizing factor across the racial divide. Now, you know, he was a unique person in many ways, but I've often felt that what's been needed is spokespeople from the Afro-American community to try to unify. I'm talking specifically about the war issues and what it does to everybody, including the black community, and how it's harmed by it. And I don't see that. And I think that's a big part of it.
Well, I think that's a hell of a thing to put on African American leadership, that we must lead the anti-war effort.
Saying you must lead it.
Well, it sounded that way. Plus, I think that there's a romanticization about King. When King led the civil rights movement, and there appeared to be white support, that's when the movement was focused on the South. The moment it became a criticism of what's happening in the North, and we saw it very clearly in Chicago in 65, where King was very precise, very clear. What happened to him in Chicago was worse than what happened in Selma, Birmingham. So I think we have a tendency to miss the, you know, we're caught in the myth of King. Now, what is clear is that King had a vision for uniting people, and what made it powerful is that he led a movement, right? He led an existing movement that had grown and gathered steam even as it divided. What we don't have today is an existing movement coming out of any community that has gained a level of legitimacy. You know, and back to Jesse Jackson, as flawed as Jesse Jackson is, he has tried to knit together this rainbow that King initially tried to organize. So it's not like African-American leaders haven't tried, but we're in another moment where they don't carry the moral the moral leadership that they once did, in part because in some ways this society is more racist than it was, right? Less overt, but more to reduce, there's a kind of script, a discourse that black leaders, black folks are expected to articulate and is not taken seriously, so that you can seem to be anti-racist, but some of the most progressive people on things other than race, right, are the absolute worst people on race, mm-hmm. right? And we can look at quote-unquote progressive institutions or units that exist at the University of Illinois and find them steeped in racism, but yet these units are perceived as being progressive.
You know, it's interesting to me that King never really attempted to mobilize. I mean, he certainly spoke lukewarmly from 65 on and militantly from 67 on against the war in Vietnam, but he never really tried to mobilize around that issue. Right. I mean, he built social movements on other grounds and then gave anti-war speeches to those social movements, but didn't directly try to mobilize. And it, when I say, you know, how wrong it is to think about the 60s movement as a white middle class movement, growing up in those years, it was King and it was preeminently Muhammad Ali and it was Cesar Chavez who, for me, made it possible to think against the war, growing up in a little town in southern Illinois and you know, almost completely devoid of anti-war opinion. But it wasn't so much that those figures were trying to mobilize for the big mass demonstrations in those in those periods. They were doing other things and carrying that organizational success and moral authority into speaking out against the war. So I think that one of the things that when Kent says moving beyond black and white, one of the things that I think that largely white organizations need to think about is that move beyond black and white is also going to create a situation in which building unity between the white left and the black left might be less important than building unity between the Latino left and the black left. And I mean, I think we need to think completely out of the box on a lot of these issues and not assume that because we don't see anything grand going on in the way of, you know, building a beloved community at the national level and nobody speaking out for that in a way that some of us might like, that there's nothing going on. These kind of unities are really hard to forge, and we may not, you know, they may take a while to develop, but those are important unities that really kind of sit outside. And people, you know, part of the reason that people don't come to AWARE meetings might well be because they're coming to other meetings that they consider to be more urgent. And people shouldn't feel badly about that. I mean, people should just say, well, that's sometimes how these things work.
Among white activists in the United States are a tiny little group in a lot of ways. I mean, it's not a mass movement. And if there are people going to meetings working on progressive issues that are relevant to their community, are there things maybe that a group like AWARE should be doing, not to pull them to our demonstration, but to say, hey, here's what we're doing, what are you doing? I mean, how do you even start those? Maybe what are some of the tried and true ways that people have built intercommunal bridges in their communities that cross racial class lines?
Well, let me give you an example, one that's coming up here, and Lisa invited me to talk about this. The 29th and 30th of September, there's an immigrant workers' freedom ride that is going to involve, how many people know about it?
Yes, been getting some press.
It involved about 10,000 people on buses in various parts of the country. First of all, traveling around their states and building demonstrations, and then turning and going to Washington to lobby, and then ending in Queens for a demonstration that the AFL, which supports this, is promising will have 250,000 people. The 29th and 30th, one of the buses from Chicago will be here in town the evening of the 29th. Juan Williams is speaking at the Brown commemoration, but there also will be some kind of demonstration around the Freedom Ride, and then at noon on the following day at the Center on Democracy in a Multiracial Society, there'll be a lunch for the 45 people on the bus, and I'll make sure that information on that goes out on your list. I think that's a perfect example of a kind of meaningful solidarity that pulls labor in, that also involves education of the largely Latino bus riders about the freedom rides in the Black freedom movement, and it actually concretely tries to build some of these bridges that we're thinking about.
There's also this question. There's a strong debate in the black left circles over the difference between organization and mobilization. And I think that old model of large demonstrations, Magruder may very well be right. I know for myself, I'm more interested in knocking on doors and talking to people and building slowly than having the Million Man March, and then nothing is built. So, you know, maybe we need to focus on more models. We're concerned about how many people we get out. The fact is that 70% of African Americans opposed the war. And so the question is how to make that politically viable, right? And it may not, demonstrations may not be the only way to do that.
Sure.
Yeah, I think what that raises is a very interesting set of questions about then what counts as a class issue in this kind of a context, and what counts as a peace issue. My son is active actually in St. Louis now in a coalition, which he hoped would be a coalition, to bring together people for a police review board and people, which St. Louis still doesn't have in any meaningful way, and people against the Patriot Act. And at the meeting where this was being cemented, the Anti-Patriot Act forces rejected the police review board forces, and in fact caused people to very bitterly leave the meeting on the grounds that the anti-police review board demand was a particularistic demand. And some of the people who took that stance were actually the people who were trying to build labor support for the coalition against the Patriot Act. And I mean, you see this in, a few years ago, Michael Moore wrote this vicious attack on Mumia supporters in the nation. But, and he talks about people being unable to concentrate on real class issues and instead seizing on Mumia's case, as if police brutality isn't a class issue and isn't the very issue that may keep people away from demonstrations. And so, I mean, I think that as we think about race and class and peace together, we have to adopt we have to ask ourselves different questions about how do class issues leave the point of production and find ways to get expressed inside communities, and what actually are issues of importance to working people.
Just a quick aside. You know, I think when King became dangerous was in Chicago, when he started focusing around housing, jobs, poverty. Vietnam, of course, was important, but it was the possibility that he would organize people and he would organize folks struggling around these everyday concerns. The question I would ask this body, what are the major concerns of blacks in Champaign? What are blacks independently organizing around? And if you want to link with them, the way to link would be around those things that they have independently decided this is what we want to focus on, and it appears to be education. and there's real possibilities there.
I spoke at Binghamton not too long ago, and there was a big student demonstration when I was speaking there, and the black students had invited me in independently of this demonstration. But the demonstration was this remarkable coalition of student groups led by the black and Puerto Rican students, and at the last minute, the white student group pulled out. The student and their reason was, and this is a very interesting phrasing, that they thought that demonstrations now were a people of colorish thing to do. That was the language that was used. So that, you know, if there's still an open question about whether white radicals are willing to participate in social movements that are led by people of color. So that, you know, success might not be success in building these things.
I'm thinking about what Sundiata just said about education being an issue in this town, which people in this room have been working on this for 20 years. And I would caution, I guess, white people, in going and colonizing that effort too.
Yeah, right.
And while I respect the idea that, you know, you go to meetings, of which there are many, and speak your piece, I think a lot of us need to shut up and sit down and listen. And so there's a lot of work to be done in the schools, but there ain't no easy answer, I don't know. But it seems like the people who are working on it and have been working on it for 20 years might be the people to listen to first before you start. I mean, people are not dumb. They obviously see that $87 billion is going to go. It's not going to go to education.
Another thing white activists can do is join groups of people of color. I mean, the NAACP is an interracial group. If you want to have a forum before the NAACP, peace activists should be in the NAACP. And if you go to church, go to a black church. You know, try it for a year and see what happens politically as a result of that. In other words, there's the peace movement is always asking people to step in. But you can just as easily step out into these other groups.
Bird, 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 cow, cow. Bird, 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 cow, cow. Silo, tractor, barn, plow. Bird, 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 cow, cow. Hayfield, hayfield, hayfield. Hayfield, hayfield, hayfield. Hayfield, hayfield, hayfield. Hayfield, hayfield, hayfield. Speed zone 30, Walmart. Walmart, Walmart, Walmart. Garden tractor, go-kart. Asphalt, asphalt, Kmart. Kmart, Kmart, gas pump. Gas pump, gas pump, gas pump. Wendy's drive-thru speed bump. Ponderosa gas pump. A duplex, duplex driveway. A duplex, duplex driveway. A duplex, duplex driveway.
That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. The coordination of the UCIMC Radio News is funded by the Funding Exchange's Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media. If you'd like to get involved with this show, drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. No experience is necessary. You can also stop by the monthly meeting of the Radio News Group, happening in 30 minutes at the IMC, 218 West Main Street in downtown Urbana. Everyone is invited. Archives of this program are available at the IMC website, www.ucimc.org. The Prince Mishkins are taking us out today, recorded 2 weekends ago live in Allen Hall on campus, doing Lou and Peter Berryman's Bird, Bird, Bird. Take care and see you next week.
House, house, trailer, yard sale. Trailer, trailer, yard sale. Tavern, high school, bike trail. Gas pump, trailer, yard sale. Road construction, eat now. Strip mall, pig farm, sow, sow. Silo, tractor, barn, plow. End construction, cow, cow. Bird, 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 cow, cow. Bird, 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 cow, cow. Silo, tractor, barn, plow. Bird, 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 cow, cow. Hay field, hay field, hay field. Hay field, hay field, hay field. Hayfield, 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 hayfield.